Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, everybody. I think we'll begin this evening's session. Apart from anything else, the room is almost full anyway. So welcome to Green Templeton College. I'm Denise Leavesley, the principal of the college, and I'd like to welcome particularly those of you who haven't been to the college before, and welcome students, fellows, and other visitors. This is the second in four lectures in our series for 2016. And the theme this year is Living by Numbers, Big Data and Society. And the series asks, what's the digital future and how will it significantly change our lives? And it aims to raise questions about the nature of developments associated with the availability and the analysis of large data sets. And the implications for core aspects of everyday life. And may I right up front thank my colleague Mary Daly for organising this series of lectures. Many of you know that Professor Shoshana Zuboff was due to give the lecture this evening. Due to really very tragic personal circumstances, she had to cancel. And we hope that she might visit us in future to give her talk. She has written to us to that effect. But this was very late. It was only last week. And we're really, truly grateful to Helen Margetts for willingly stepping in at the last minute. I didn't have to twist any arms. She accepted immediately. And I think that's absolutely magnificent. And the number of people in the audience speaks volumes about how excited we are at hearing Helen. So in this lecture, Helen, who's the director of the Oxford Internet Institute and professor of society and the internet here at Oxford, will talk about the internet, how the internet and social media can bring about political change, allowing tiny acts of political participation which can scale up to large mobilisation of millions, but that mostly fail. Helen Margetts is a political scientist. She specialises in digital era governance and politics, investigating political behaviour, digital government, government-citizen interactions in the age of the internet, social media and big data. She's published over 100 books, articles, and major research projects, reports in this area, including the recent book, which will be the focus of her talk tonight, Political Turbulence, How Social Media Shape Collective Action. But I'd also mention some other of her books, The Paradoxes of Modernization, Digital Era Governance, The Tools of Government in the Digital Age. In 2003, she and Patrick Dunleavy won the Political Scientist Making a Difference Award from the UK Political Studies Association, in part for a series of policy reports on government and on the internet for the UK National Audit Office. And I think one of the things that she's really known for is the policy impact of her research. She sits on many, many committees, but the Digital Advisory Board of the UK Government Digital Service and the World Economic Forum Global Agenda Council on the Future of Government should be mentioned. She's a fellow of the Academy of the Social Sciences. Helen Margetts joined the Oxford Internet Institute in 2004 from UCL, where she was Professor in Political Science and Director in the School of Public Policy. She's a really great person for us to have here at Green Templeton because we care very deeply about interdisciplinarity. And social science, of course, is one of the areas that we specialise in. So I can't imagine a better person to talk to this year's theme. And we're really very, very lucky to have her on her doorstep, on our doorstep. Now, turning to tonight's talk, Political Turbulence, How Social Media Shapes Collective Action. The plan for this evening is that Helen will speak for 35 to 40 minutes, thereabouts. And then we'll open the floor for questions and discussion. But one of the very special things about this evening is that we have two of her co-authors on the Political Turbulence book, Scott Hale and Taha Yassiri. So they'll be joining Helen for discussion, which is fantastic. And we'll aim to finish at about 7:20 or thereabouts, when Richard Cuthbertson, the vice principal of Green Templeton College, will propose a vote of thanks. So I've said enough. I'll pass across to Helen with my warm thanks.
Thank you very much, Denise. Thank you very much for inviting us, even though even at the last moment, spontaneity is always good. And thank you all very much for coming. I can see several old friends in the audience and some newer ones as well. It's great to be here. As Denise said, I'm director of the Oxford Internet Institute. For anyone who doesn't know, we're a multidisciplinary department in the Social Sciences Division of the University of Oxford. We kind of live and breathe multidisciplinarity. And just to prove that, here we are. I'm a political scientist, as Denise said. Scott Hale is a computer scientist, although sort of reformed, slightly reformed, and recovering. And Taha Yassiri is a physicist, also recovering, but not completely. And we're here because I'm going to talk about the book that we've just written. This is the book. If anything gets really complicated and I have to, and I'm skating over or not being clear, I'm going to say, oh, well, there's much more about that in the book. If anybody's interested in the book, there is a leaflet at the front and outside where you can get it cheaper, much cheaper than the... a bit cheaper. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. So this book is written by myself, Peter John, who's not here. He's another political scientist from UCL. Taha and Scott. And the aim of this book was really to understand the relationship between digital technologies in general and the growing phenomenon of social media and politics, mobilization, collective action, even the nature of democracy itself. We wanted to try and kind of draw out everything we could find out about what we perceive to be a changing world, and think about what that meant in the round, what the overall political trends in a digital age are turning out to be now that we've had a decade or even two at it. Just a couple of definitions of terms, which are kind of crucial to what I'm going to say. By social media, we mean internet-based platforms that allow users to generate content of some kind. And therefore, we would include something like a platform where your content is a very small contribution, even if you're just viewing a video or signing a digital petition or something like that. We're counting that as content. So it includes all the normal things you think of as social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp and so on. But it also includes some sort of specially custom-built platforms aimed at political activity. And by collective action, we take the standard political science definition of any activity undertaken by citizens with the aim of contributing to public goods. We mean political participation, anything that we can define loosely as a political act. And of course, I'll say more about that. So we wanted to understand the relationship between that and that. And that's what I'm going to talk about. The premise, as I said, was that increasingly people's lives are intertwined with digital technologies, the internet, social media, platforms of the sharing economy, Uber and so on. Basically, digital platforms of all kinds. And we spend growing amount of our time there. That's a relatively uncontroversial thing to say. And what I'm going to argue is that as well as that making a difference to politics, to democratic participation, it also generates new forms of data. and new possibilities for how we might understand the political world. So those are the key kind of aims of this talk, to talk about both those things. So obviously people are used to the idea that growing by now most people are online in North America, in Europe. I mean, we don't all sign up to the belief of an economist that I work with sometimes, who says we just have to wait for the people who don't use the internet to die. We don't all sign up to that view, of course, but we're used to the idea that most people are online. And actually, the figures are quite interesting if you delve into them further. Actually, most people who aren't online can get some kind of proxy or friend or member of their family who would use the internet or social media for them if they needed to do it. One person can often act as an access point for a family or a group, particularly in the developing world. So we're used to those figures being high, but, I mean, it's growing everywhere. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, we have to keep updating that figure for the percentage of people who have access to the internet, and it's definitely over 20% by now. So that's continuing to rise. And when it comes to social media, these are the global figures for Facebook usage. Facebook in some countries is incredibly ubiquitous. In Spain, for example, incredibly large percentage of the population on Facebook. And well over 60% of UK of the population of the UK use Facebook. And that's just one social media platform. Social media platforms are almost ubiquitous among younger people, and the average number of accounts that a young person in their teens has is 5. And anybody with teenage children here, as I do, will perfectly believe that. So what's happening here? What difference does social media make for politics? Well, what we argue is that social media allow what we call tiny acts of participation, micro donations of time and effort to social and political causes. All the time on social media, you're being invited to do something, even if it's only to watch a video clip, to look at a photo, to share something, to tweet something, to retweet something, to sign something, to add your name in the easiest possible way to some sort of campaign. These are very small acts of participation, signing a petition, as I said, liking something, sharing something. But we argue that they are acts of politics, they are acts of political participation, and they're qualitatively new in that in an earlier time, once you've signed a petition, of course, you can share it on Twitter and reach millions of people, or on Facebook and so on. Most petitions are signed via social media. Here's an example. When we say micro donations, we're not talking about money, but of course you can now contribute very small quantities of money to all kinds of causes, to your local canal, to forced marriage. For example, that's just a poster in a restroom in Heathrow Airport. Political scientists never stop working. So what we say about these tiny acts of participation is that they're new because in an earlier time, the transaction costs would just have been so great to do something so small. Just contributing £3 for something, unless you happen to come across the right bucket for the cause you wanted to donate to. But in general, these very tiny acts would have been impossible in an earlier political world. And that means that our kind of ladder of participation, as any political scientist here will know, we're used to the idea of a ladder of participation where sort of dying for a political cause is kind of the greatest cost you can perhaps imagine, and then something very small at the bottom. And the smallest thing really used to be something like signing a petition in the street or something like that. And what we argue is that these tiny acts extend the ladder at the bottom end, and that they're drawing huge quantities of new people into politics. Now, that's not an uncontroversial statement, particularly in the UK. In the UK, we have a culture of politics, which is a sort of, we call it the politics as pain principle. If it's not painful or boring or cold or involves getting wet and walking, trudging up a street or something like that, it's not politics. Interestingly, This is a quote from Tony Wright, who used to be the chair of the Parliamentary Public Administration Select Committee, where I gave evidence back in 99. And he asked me what difference the internet was going to make to politics. Of course, I had no idea what was to come, but I'm kind of quite an optimistic person, and I had some ideas about what might happen. And this is what he said. If you describe it in that casual, incidental way that gives a picture of people in the sense of having nothing better to do than press buttons, you know, it doesn't count as politics. That was the argument. I was at an event a year or so ago, which Tony Wright was actually attending, and I asked my colleagues, I was speaking here about the internet and politics, and I asked them if they thought he would mind if I actually read back that quote, and we'd all have a bit of a laugh. And they said they thought it would be fine. I thought he'd be kind of embarrassed, maybe, or ashamed. But no, he was good with it. He was nodding as I read it out. So, you know, there are big tranches of the political culture that are still good with that statement. Many of them may be in the audience. I don't know yet. Anyway, what we argue, what we talk about in the book, that those tiny acts of participation can scale up to very large mobilizations, which are challenging authoritarian and democratic regimes all over the world. Of course, the people here in Tahrir Square in Egypt in the March of Millions, or even these people in democratic Spain campaigning for the new political movement Podemos, they're undertaking more than a tiny act, of course. But what we argue was it was tiny acts that got them out there on the street. Halfway to the March of Millions, The Facebook page We Are All Khaled Said is showing a young man brutally beaten by the Egyptian police, had over 500,000 likes. Each of those tiny acts sending a signal to the next person that this might be viable, that they might get a million people on the street, that it might be worth paying attention, that this wasn't going to go away. And each act, we argue, makes that kind of difference. It would be difficult to point to a single country in the world that hasn't had some kind of, and most countries many, mobilisation, perhaps not on this scale, but still offering some kind of challenge to the regime. Difficult to find a single country that hasn't had something like this that seems to have something to do with social media. And of course, tiny though these acts are, they can affect people's individual lives. The penetration of mobile phones in Syria is over 80%. If you were a refugee fleeing Syria, you easily might prioritise a mobile phone over anything else other than the most basic resources to stay alive. Even with a mobile phone that's not a smartphone, you can still text a photo. Somebody in Germany texted that photo probably of people in a German football stadium, that photo probably affected some people's decision, or certainly went into the calculus of some people's decision about where to go. And, of course, we are all familiar with the idea that social campaigns based on social media have changed public policy. The first one was in the UK was the petition on road pricing, which caused the Brown administration to abandon their policy on administration. But there've been lots afterwards: the privatisation of forests, NHS reforms. There've been any number of policies where some kind of social media fueled, or perhaps entirely on social media campaign, altered the course of events. One thing we do need to make clear, and it's a crucial part of their argument, is that almost all of them fail. This graph shows all petitions to the UK government over a couple of years. I think actually it's 3 years. The big sort of red, dark red, dense bit at the bottom shows petitions that completely failed, basically got less than 500 signatures. Only the yellow ones right at the top, that's a logarithmic scale, by the way, got over 100,000 signatures, which is what you need for a parliamentary debate. What's interesting is it's that 99.99% of petitions do not get a parliamentary debate. Most of them go nowhere. In fact, that feeling you get when you tweet something and nobody retweets it or probably even looks at it, that feeling, or you put something on Facebook and nobody likes it, that feeling, you're not alone. It's happening to the vast majority of political activity on social media. What makes some succeed and what fail? Well, it's not the issue. Here's marked on this graph are three petitions, all in support of cute badgers. Well, then, badgers are not very cute, but they scrub up well. Three petitions, one of which got less than 10 signatures, one which got somewhere in the middle, you know, a few thousand signatures, and the other one got over 100,000 and got a parliamentary debate. Not the issue. And not the ideology either. We can show you, you know, petitions that have come from the left, come from the right, come from any political ideology that have been successful or not successful. But I'm just going to take a step back afterwards. This, after all, this is a lecture series about numbers, and say something about data. Because the same phenomenon that's giving us all that mobilisation is giving us huge quantities of data, new sorts of data. Any social scientist here has surely at some point in their lives bemoaned the fact that as social scientists, we completely lack data. We particularly lack transactional data. We have survey data, which is extremely expensive, about what people think they did or think they might do, or believe, but real-time transactional data is something that is traditionally in short supply. Tiny acts of participation, and that's particularly true of political science, hence the wide-scale reliance on opinion polls, which have been having a bit of a bad year. So the point is that every tiny act of participation generates digital data. We can model that mathematically. Perhaps we can identify characteristics of success and failure. We can use it to test the effect of certain types of social media. We can reveal natural experiments in the data when things change and see the effect of that change. We can run experiments ourselves in the lab or in the field to actually test the effect of a platform design. And ultimately, we ought to get better at forecasting and predicting political activity, which just recently we have so conspicuously failed to do. So that's my step backwards for a minute. These are new numbers for collective action, new sorts of data, which have the potential to change the way that we look at the political world. So there's an example, for example, the petitions I showed you. We've been scraping every single signature on every single petition from the web for several years now. We have a data set of 50 million signatures. I know it's not big in biomedical terms, but for political science, I promise that's exciting. 10 million petitioners across the UK. For any petition, we can show you the precise geographical breakdown of who cares about that issue and who doesn't care about that issue or that group of issues. We can look at that data to show you something that distinguishes those that are successful. Here are all the petitions receiving more than 10,000 signatures. You can see straight away, just from that descriptive piece of data, that the successful ones seem to be going straight up immediately. And that led us to further exploration. We can see that pattern. That pattern is replicated both for petitions in the UK and the US, and probably any other country that runs a petition site. But you can replicate that pattern also on other social media. Here are YouTube videos showing the pattern of videos. Some of these are deeply serious subjects. Here the girl Neda Aga Sultan, who was killed in the Iranian protests of 2009, became the face of the protests in a way. A video of her was shared across the world. A million a million views. And you can see there, going up straight away. Much less seriously, infinitely less seriously, President Obama singing Call Me Maybe. 40 million views, again, 10 million in a matter of hours. Obama versus Mitt Romney rap battles, also straight up. And here, again more seriously, Eric Garner, who died in police custody, again, on the I Can't Breathe hashtag, the video of him, going up quickly, going flat for a while, and then failure to indict the police who were involved, again, another sharp rise. That pattern, delving into that pattern more deeply, this is Facebook and Twitter data, just to get the picture that it's replicated across platforms. Here you can see again that right across all the hashtags that were significant in the last year in the period of mobilisation against policing. Ferguson, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Black Lives Matter, I Can't Breathe, all of them either flat and then straight up, or straight up, going along and then straight up again on failure to indict. What's noticeable about each of these mobilisations, as a political scientist, what we would expect to see for collective action is a kind of gentle S-shape, a gradual accumulation, a tipping point, and then finishing with the top of the S. We have looked at all of these everywhere. We've had several arguments about it, some of which involved words I can't repeat, but also the words, no, it is not an S-shape. Obviously, we looked for S-shapes. One of the arguments that I particularly wanted to test with the data for this book was a theory about why collective action and mobilisation would be an S-shape. So it was a bit of a shock not to find any, but we really, really didn't find any. Just to finish a more recent example, the important decision whether to block or not block Donald Trump from the UK in response to his assertion that all Muslims should be blocked from the US. You can see, again, this very steep uprise to the, really a very, very rapid rise up to that petition, which got well over a logarithmic scale again, well over 500,000 signatures. And there's a couple of things here. One is that an S-shape would be easier to predict. We're seeing a lot of unpredictable things happening in politics these days. S-shapes would be much easier to predict. You'd sort of see them coming. You'd see that gradual. You'd sort of hear about it, and suddenly everybody would be talking about it. But things like this are happening very quickly indeed, even the Don't Ban Trump one, which was not so successful and didn't get 100,000 signatures. So you can see that for policymakers, this is a very confusing world. We've got one or two outliers here which don't comply with our overall pattern, but you can also see that there's a lot of basically a lot of petitions in the migration area there which are going nowhere, and two or three which are really, 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 really going to the top. We've spent some time, we can't work out exactly how many people have signed a petition involving some kind of issue related to migration in the past few months, but it's definitely in the millions. We've modelled that data, looking at the extent, trying to look at it the other way round, looking at the way in which the attention that's being paid to something decays quickly, to explain that sharp uprise pattern. And again, the same finding replicated. If something doesn't make it in a matter of about 10 hours, it's probably going to be sort of digital dust. And there's nothing normal about this distribution. The distribution of mobilisations looks a lot more like earthquakes than it does what we might expect of political. We might expect to see some sort of normal distribution. Some make it, some don't, but a gradual sort of bell-shaped curve. This is the complete opposite of this. It's what's called a leptokurtic distribution, a small number of extreme events and lots of tiny, insignificant events. And we've seen that pattern replicated over and again. So how can we delve in? I promised that we would somehow delve into the dynamics of this sort of mobilisation, and that is what we've tried to do in the rest of the book. And as I said, and as I'm sure you've observed, we're seeing a lot of unpredictable things happening. Jeremy Corbyn, where did he come from? How did that happen? Why did nobody in any sense predict that? And if you think about it, that's been happening ever since the Arab Spring. After the financial crash of 2008, as a political scientist, we used to like sort of laughing at economists a bit and say, "Ha, didn't see that coming, did you?" But of course, after the Arab Spring, it rather sort of went off that topic because there were political scientists, I'm sorry, even saying it wasn't going to come to anything, even after the Tunisian Revolution. The political commentator, Malcolm Gladwell, famously wrote an article just in 2010 entitled "Why the Revolution Won't Be Tweeted." So lots of unpredictable things happening over a sustained period of time. And the traditional sort of predictors in politics terms, in political science terms, are not working. Demographics is how we predict political activity, for example. The conventional wisdom is that young people, they don't participate, they don't care about politics, they're not interested in politics. But young people seem to be participating in droves, and they even seem to be electing quite old people to become leader of a very old political party. So all the traditional demographic predictors are being chucked on our head. And part of what we do in the book is to explore some other possible predictors. After all, if the costs of participation are very, very low, then we might expect that the normal sort of resource-based argument that people of lower socioeconomic status or an impoverished socio-environmental context are less likely to participate. But if the costs are very small, perhaps that's all turned on its head. And I think that is what you're seeing with young people. I think young people are signing petitions, joining mobilizations, blocking Donald Trump, for example, very popular among teenagers, contributing not only to UK politics in that there was a debate, that the petition led to a debate in Parliament, but also a tiny bit perhaps to US politics as well. So we investigated things like personality, and I think that that is a very fruitful line for the future. There's a growing body of work in political science that looks at personality as a predictor of political behaviour, and we definitely found some evidence for that, particularly in terms of extroversion. Those are the big five characteristics. We also looked at locus of control, whether somebody has an internal or external locus of control, what that meant to where they were willing to undertake an act of participation or not, an individualistic and cooperative people. The other thing we looked at, and actually related to what we looked at with respect to personality, I mean, this to us is the key of the dynamics of participation on social media. There's two things that you experience on social media that you don't experience in other contexts. One of them is social information. We know in real time what other people are doing. We know how many people have viewed something, how many people have shared, how many people follow. And that effect, we know from decades of social science research that that affects the way we behave. If you sign a petition on the street or something like that in an earlier time, you've no idea how many other people have signed it. The person who gives you the clipboard will tell you it's everyone signing it, but you have to trust them. You don't know. Social information, we know in real time, and that is what we believe is causing these chains of chain reactions between tiny acts of participation. The other thing is visibility. If you undertake something, your action is visible to the outside world. We saw that in the Ice Bucket Challenge. What, everybody remember the Ice Bucket Challenge? Anybody participate in the Ice Bucket Challenge? Basically, the Ice Bucket Challenge was about shaming people into giving money for charity. The mechanism was visibility. You quite often are visible to social media. You're visible to far more people, far more likely to get your 15 minutes of fame in early and often. And the ice bucket challenge was about using that mechanism by making people ashamed about not giving money. Of course, when it gave the point, when it came to the point of actually giving the money, far less people gave the money because nobody could see you then. But at the point when you were pouring the bucket of water over your head, people knew that you were doing it. Again, known through decades of social science research to be an important influence on behaviour. So this is one of the moments when I say read all about it in the book if you're interested. We carried out experiments of various kinds, lab, field and natural experiments. There isn't time to go into them all. But I we'll just say a couple of headline findings. One thing we found that we were very interested in how mobilisations get kicked off. Who goes early when actually there's very little social information, when levels of social information are very, very low? Or perhaps there's no one. No one's done anything. There's no signs of visibility. What we found is extroverts, people who record with an extrovert personality, were the ones who were willing to go at that point. Agreeable people, nice, amiable, agreeable people, they would only go late when most of the other people had joined in. We found varied responses to visibility. Individualists, people who come into the kind of pro-self category, are very shameable. So if you make them visible, they almost universally contribute more to some kind of public good in a public goods game. Cooperatives are not shameable, and if you try and shame them, they may actually give less. Interesting differences between personality. Just to show that quickly in action, this is a natural experiment of the kind I mentioned at the beginning. So every time a platform gets changed, a social media platform gets changed, the implications of that change are played out in the world at large. So this is the petitions platform that I showed you the data from before. This is the front page, and the people who ran the petitions platform decided to introduce a trending option. So they tell you people what were the most popular petitions. They said it wouldn't make too much difference to the way people chose petitions or anything, but they did it in the US and they were keen to do it as well in the UK. So, of course, we could look at that data before and after that change was introduced. And we found that contrary to their expectations, it actually did make a difference. The point was that although there weren't more signatures after that change was introduced, they were concentrated around those trending petitions. I mean, we would have predicted that, but the people who introduced the platform change didn't predict that. So all the kind of things that are worth knowing and the key, the kind of pointer to be able to influence this kind of behaviour in the future. Those are the protests in Brazil against rising prices, rising poverty, and the president's decision to spend so much money on the Olympic Games and the World Cup. And I'm showing it just there because just one final feature of the kind of mobilisation we're talking about. We're saying that most fail, but when they succeed, it is possible to get someone, to get a million people into a square without any of the normal organisational trappings of a political movement or a revolution. When Dilma Rousseff asked to speak to the leaders of these protesters to start kind of discussing about how to get them off the streets, she was told, leaders, there aren't any leaders. There are no leaders. And we've seen that over and over again. And it's probably the answer why so many of the revolutions of the Arab Spring or the demonstrations or mobilizations since then have actually been disappointing. There are real questions of sustainability here. And it's probably part of the reason why Jeremy Corbyn struggles so much, for example, although he comes from mainstream politics, he comes from outside the party organisation. And that means that when he tries to lead, he has none of the mechanisms for doing so. Of course, having voted against his own party 500 times, he doesn't really have the sort of mechanisms of loyalty and leadership that we would expect in the leader, somebody who's been elected with such an overwhelming majority. So just to sum up, tiny acts of participation can scale up to large-scale mobilisations, usually fail, influenced by social information and visibility, but visibility is quite inefficient because it works by shaming, and if there's no one there to do the shaming, it won't work. Lacking leaders, institutions and organisations shaped by personality rather than demographics, all those things making mobilisation more unpredictable than it's been before, more unstable and often unsustainable, as we've seen. All those things leading to what we call political turbulence. We chose the word turbulence for a particular reason, because what we were observing was something that was clearly dynamic, unpredictable behaviour, high sensitivity to the initial conditions, non-linear relationships, obviously high interconnectivity, tipping points. It looks like a chaotic system. It looks like the weather, but it's political activity. And part of the argument of the book is that we can and we should develop new ways of modelling political systems a bit more like natural systems. We need to get better at understanding politics in this way, using the kind of models that we might bring from the natural scientists. And that's why I don't think we could have written this book without the kind of multidisciplinary team that we have. I want to leave plenty of time for discussion, so I'm going to miss that out. Again, it's going to be one of those moments where I say it's in the book.
You've got time if you want to.
Have I? Okay. People don't usually say that to you. Sorry.
That's all right.
Does that mean it's not recording now?
No, it's still recording off the other microphones.
That's actually right.
This one is a little bit clearer when it works.
Sorry, we threw you by saying
that. Yes, it's failed.
You've got another 5 minutes or so if you'd like to speak.
Working anymore, I'm afraid. So I think if that's all, if you're right to use that one.
Yes, I'm trying to kind of cuddle up to it. Yeah, okay. I said at the beginning the overall aim of the book, I mean, the original idea behind it was to try and sort of encapsulate a complex political world with some kind of democratic model. The name we came... Actually, this was originally the name of the book, but the publishers didn't really like the word chaotic and they didn't really like the word pluralism. They said both things would be bad names for a book, so we had to abandon that, but that is what the last chapter's called. I think they were actually right, but still. I thought of it, so I was disappointed. I think what we're seeing, it reminds us most of the pluralist models of the 50s and 60s in US political science. The idea that there's no overweening centre of power or influence, that there's some kind of pluralist pattern of competing interests, and that for every interest, there'll be some kind of mobilisation. Of course, the pluralist model was revised and had NEO stuck in front of it several times, and even post-bureaucratic pluralism made an entry in the 1990s. But what all of those have in common, and you don't think of this when you hear the word pluralism, but if you actually read the text, what you find is really something quite ordered. It's a kind of idea that for every interest there'll be a group, and there's some kind of idea of an image of kind of guilds and workers' associations and trade unions in most of these models. Of course, there's interesting variations, and even if I've got a bit of extra time, I'm sure I haven't got time to go into them. Actually, if you a reread of Paul Hurst's Associationalism, a dear colleague of mine at Birkbeck College, where I also worked, is perhaps the one that has most to say, surprisingly, because Paul was a person who used to use his computer to put yellow post-it notes on to remind himself to do things rather than actually switch it on. But he got it, really, actually. I mean, the models he talks about in there are very reminiscent of what we're finding here. But in summary, I mean, all those models are far neater and more organised and more predictable, particularly in terms of something like neo-pluralism, where it was viewed that the weight of big business was recognised, far more organised and ordered than what we are observing here. What we are observing is far more disorganised, it's fast moving, it's far more individualised, and it's not group-based, however much interest groups will tell you that they're sort of in charge and they're organising it all. That is not the impression we're getting. It's not what the data is telling us. When we looked at any other models of democracy, the Habermasian public sphere came to reign. The idea of a Republican kind of public sphere where people discussed political issues of the day in the coffee houses of Vienna, often quoted. We get a huge amount of applications to the Oxford Internet Institute, who people who are going to show that the public sphere exists in a kind of the deliberative dream. We're saying no evidence for the deliberative dream, and I could say more about that. We're seeing much more something about tiny acts, which I'm not deriding or saying that they're not important, and I'm saying that they scale up and they tell us something about what people believe and feel and need and prefer. But we're not seeing deliberation making the difference. So this is the last slide, and I want to end there with a sort of word about the future. Nothing that we found in our exploration is going away, in my view. If there's one thing I can predict, it's unpredictability. And there's things we're going to need to develop. One of them are the sort of methods that we used in this study. Generation of new sorts of data, mathematical model, drawing in some natural science methods and models. Experimentation is going to be critical. In a world of big data, causal inference is going to be a very difficult thing to get hold of. And we have to get better at finding experiments in data sets, in terms of natural experiments, or designing experiments in lab and field, which help us to understand the story behind what the data is telling us. I think that's going to be crucial in a big data world. The field of machine learning but I don't really know the composition of the audience, but how many social scientists are here?
It depends on the definition.
Yeah, I know.
I think they are social
scientists. Yeah. We could go into that in some length, but I think what I want to say anyway is that everyone is going to need to work together. The development of machine learning, of developing ways to predict from patterns observed in data, in working out the algorithms to be able to predict, are going to need both kind of social science understanding, multivariate social science understanding, as well as the computational skills of people who are developing machine learning. And we shouldn't let it just happen. We shouldn't let it happen in kind of ghettos. We should all be doing it together. I'm talking about the political world, but I think there's a point here more generally about the social world. We desperately need an ethical framework that's urgent and essential because, everything I've shown you here is squeaky clean, but there's all sorts of data that we might have been able to get if we hadn't been following some kind of nascent ethical framework, which we kind of believe in. But researchers and policymakers alike are looking for guidance on the ethics of all this. What data can you take? What data can you analyse? Where can you use people's names and link them up with other data sets, and where can't you? We're at the very beginning of kind of knowing what to do about that. Data sources, working with internet corporations. So I've tried to explain what I think can be done with data, what we believe, the kind of thing that we can do in the future. But there's huge, huge sources of data that I haven't shown you because we can't get it. because nobody can get it. And that's going to be crucial for social science. You're talking about platforms, you know, which the vast majority of people are spending all their time on. We walk around dripping with data. Just the mobile phone in the pocket, you know, is enough. But actually being able to use that data to understand the social and political world is something that we have to work at getting some kind of safe environment where that kind of data can be used for research, I believe. We have to be more imaginative in the ways that we do that. Making use of data for policy making, service delivery. I think what we've described, I mean, the political turbulence, it provides an opportunity for policymakers because it provides them with lots of transactional data, which is real data about what people are experiencing from service delivery, the feeding back on service delivery, how policymaking is playing out in society. All sorts of possibilities to kind of harness that data, people's willingness to do stuff, to undertake tiny acts, to improve policy making and service delivery. But it's a challenge. There's a lot of challenges there. There's a data science community of interest in government, but it's kind of fairly small, and it's difficult for policymakers to deliver to develop the kind of skills and expertise that are needed. One of the reasons why I am a very enthusiastic proponent of the Alan Turing Institute for Data Science, which the University of Oxford is a partner in, which some people here are involved in. I can see one, two, anyway. And at the Oxford Internet Institute, we have been involved in that and are very keen to see it going forward, is because there is so much potential being wasted. Big data has been such a huge thing in the corporate world and much less of a thing in the public and even social world. Linking methodologies that link kind of these kind of data sources, these very kind of shallow large data sources, to individual level data, either genomic data or survey data or whatever, more traditional sources of data. There's some fascinating linking methodologies around which are only at the beginning of being developed. And the final thing is bringing multidisciplinarity into the mainstream. As I said at the beginning, so you've got three of the authors of this book here, a political scientist, a computer scientist, and a physicist. I started my research career at the London School of Economics, and I always imagined that one day I'd probably go back there, but if I think of doing this kind of research at a university that only has social science, I think that would be quite a challenge, possibly impossible. Anyway, thank you.